challenges to occupy my time. The magical fair, interrupted by sudden dragon attack, was closed up prematurely. Instead of running the spellmonger's trial as planned, I held a brief court and awarded 3 shards of Irionite to wizards who displayed great courage, selflessness, and heroics during the attack and its aftermath. No one complained. A dragon and a few score wyverns were far more challenging than whatever spells I could come up with. No feast of champions, no grand fates by the various magical orders. But with all the funerals we had to attend, there really wasn't much time. More than 300 people died during the attack. Some were burned alive, some were killed by wyverns or other hazards in the battle. A few had perished fighting the Nemavorti directly. The clergy of the town held a mass ceremony, and Brigga honored their sacrifice by extending the Everfire more than 60 feet high during the rite. Some bodies were loaded on the carts of the Silent Brothers, those monks who specialized in transporting the dead. More were buried in the common temple plots. Part of my job as baron and host of the fair meant consoling and compensating the survivors and their loved ones. I had to meet with families, friends, and business partners of the deceased. As the responsible party at the fair, I had certain legal and moral obligations to those who died there. Likewise, I had a debt to my vassals. They hadn't done anything to warrant a dragon attack. They'd taken up arms and defended the domain valiantly, and they had suffered egregiously. Many parts of Sevendor had as well. Brestal was hit particularly badly in the attack. The village was a smoking ruin now, with but one home in 3 still standing intact. The fields had scorched just days before the final harvest, and the young fruit and nut trees we'd planted just a few years before were blackened sticks now. Brestal Tower was no more. The roof and the top story were burnt and melted to the point where even the basalt rock behind the tower was blasted. Nearby Hollyborough lost 2 satellite burrows, 12 dead in all, who perished when a stray blast of fire torched the woven wooden balls they lived in. Olmeg the Green was beside himself, both for the trees and the loss of his Talalon subjects. The dike tower was damaged, as were parts of Bovol village, across the road from the gateway fortress. Bovol Hall, the inn, and 2 large houses had seen both collateral fire damage and the insult of wyverns landing and attacking the people. The people defended themselves fiercely, and with the help of Zagor and a couple of visiting enchanters staying at the inn, they put an end to them and their gruesome riders. Sire Kay's yeoman, Rollo, had grabbed an axe off the wall of the hall and rushed out to fight a wyvern, cleaving its neck in 2 with 1 mighty blow. His neighbor, Yeoman Vano of Brestal, was just as valiant, leading a band of his villagers through the burning village against a mounted wyvern and its nemavort. 9 Brestali perished in the battle, and Vano took a nasty wound, but when they were done they'd pulled the fell rider off his scaly mount and beaten him back to the necromancer's halls. The nemavort may have been looking for magi, but he found the blunt end of a 7-dory mallet. There was other damage. Lesgathiel would have to be almost entirely rebuilt, Master Goody reported, as the foundations had been heated so hot he could not guarantee their stability. But the waypoint there was now sealed off, and guarded by both Elkin magic and war magi. Lady Varen and her staff moved to the Terra Alon encampment in Hosendor until work could be completed. Sevendor town, thankfully, had only taken light damage. The tiled roof of the Bouleuterion's workshop was burnt, though spells kept the rest of the structure from igniting. A few of the spires atop residences of prominent wizards in town had sheared off in the fight, smashed by flailing wings or the odd spell. A couple of fires on residential rooftops were far more damaging. Wyvern attacks had occurred all over town, requiring the town watch, fairgoers, and townsmen to see to their defense. Dozens had perished in the battles. Then there was the former millhouse and bathhouse on the edge of the millpond, now both destroyed by the flailing beast, as well as the 50 tons of ice dragon in the middle of our water supply, and the score of dead giant wyvern corpses, as well as a few rotting Nemavorti bodies. Someone had to clean that up. Part of my job was to congratulate the living. Dara's Skyriders had performed magnificently after their terrible defeat at Olam Saheri. I lavished them with praise, rewards, and acclaim, and, at least partially, redeemed myself in Dara's eyes. I gave a rousing speech, praising the valour of the brave war magi visiting the fair who'd pitched in with the defence, and praised, even more, the common folk who'd come to Seven Dwarfs' defence in her need. It's one thing to leap on the back of a wyvern to slash its throat when you're armoured, armed, and used to that sort of thing. It's quite another when you're a barber or an out-of-work ploughman. The Riverlords, the militia, the town guards and fair wardens, who'd acted to evacuate the fairgrounds when the first sign of trouble appeared, all were praised and rewarded. I gave away silver like it was water, and never regretted a coin. My people performed admirably. They saved lives even as they risked their own. Bannermore got a lot of credit, both from me and from the people at large. He'd kept his fair wardens organized and orderly when it was clear people were in danger. Despite his reputation for loving gold, he'd sacrificed plenty when he put the welfare of the fair folk in front of his own fortune. Our neighbours were graciously helpful. Baron Arathaniel sent monks and bandages, as did my vassals and my friend, Sire Sigalan. Treston Dor faithfully came to our aid with carts and horses to help move the wounded, and work crews to help clear away the burnt timbers and ashes. The baronial domains around Seven Dwar were likewise quick to respond to the aftermath of the crisis. Wagons rolled through all three entryways to the domain for days. I was proudest of my own household. Apart from Dara, Rutherall and Sire Kay each won acclaim, the former for his work with the water elemental, and the latter for dueling a nemivort who was determined to interrupt the Bulyuterion, no doubt to collect the enchanters within us for use as hosts. Sire Kay was coming from the castle on his charger then, and tarried to butcher both reptile and rider in a heroic display of arcane chivalry. The enchanters, for their part, had taken up station on the roof of the ramshackle enchanters guild and cast spells against fire, as well as discharging wands and staves they were working on. You don't have to be a war mage to mumble a mnemonic and unleash arcane death, not if you were the wizard who placed the spell in the first place. The clergy had been as valiant in the aftermath and recovery as the defenders had been during the attack. Holy Hill sent a score of nurses to assist the wounded, and every temple on the street of temples contributed space as makeshift hospitals. Some of the monks and nuns eschewed services entirely until the emergency was past. I made a point of visiting each of them and praising their efforts, as well as dropping generous donations into the hands of the high clergy. Nothing says thank you like an unexpected budgetary surplus. I was involved with all of it, but my mind was rarely on what I was doing, even when I was embracing a sobbing widow upon news of her husband's death, or a sole daughter who found out one of the hopelessly charred corpses in the Temple of Trigg was her father. My mind was in the mountain, thinking of Alia and whatever the handmaiden was doing with her. If there is one constant distraction in the feudal universe, however, it's politics. Seven Dwar had been only lightly damaged compared to the pounding the capital took that day, where we lost but 300. Castor Briel lost over 7,000, including the core of the ducal government when the spire of Donrad fell. The court had just officially returned from its usual summer sojourn in Wilderhall, and while Count Moran and a few other officials were at the Curia, the rest of the government was settling in for the autumn's seasonal business. They were all dead now. Those few who'd enjoyed the fortune of errands outside of the palace during the attack were now running what little government there was in Castal. The city was under military law, with Count Moran and Viscount Puramar, the acting minister of war, attempting to maintain order while the city recovered from the disaster. Their highnesses had withdrawn in grief back to Wilderhall after the funeral. That had been a somber affair, by report. The clergy of the city had tried to bring solace to the people, but when Prince Tavard spoke, he thundered against the darkness in the west until he had the vast crowd screaming in defiance and anger. A population that had suffered so grievously was fertile ground for such rage. Entire blocks had burned under the dragon's fire. The conflagration had quickly spread across the closely packed rooftops of the city until wards, blocks away from the attack, were ablaze. And the fire spread quickly. Hundreds of homes had burned, and scores more had been devastated by the dragon. That was in addition to the great Donrad spire falling, its flaming expanse crushing the sprawling palace below. The nobles' quarter around it was quickly engulfed too. Castor Briel apparently isn't as rigorous about fire regulation spells as Seven Dwar. The ground attack by the undead wasn't as bad as I'd feared. Corbal hadn't done his homework well, for one thing. Castabriel has nearly 500,000 people in it, and probably 300 magi at any one time. Sending a few Nemovorti and some Draugan to fight their way through that was just foolish. Between the city guards and Draenor's war magi, the last of the undead were destroyed before the last fire was extinguished. The combination of the two assaults had damaged the spirit of the city of 10,000 lights. When the living dead roam your streets, and the town is on fire, it has an effect on the psyche of the population. It was compounded by the loss in the royal family. The death of the infant Prince Heir had devastated the town that had celebrated his birth and name day so recently. What was left of the court was officially and unofficially in mourning. While the princess managed to hang on to her pregnancy, she took to her bed, nearly catatonic over her loss, for a week before she was moved to Wilderhall. Tavard, meanwhile, stalked around the charred ruins of his palace and screamed orders. His anger and rage and hopeless desire to re-establish control of his world, making him more and more abusive. Rumor was that he screamed at Count Moran for 3 hours about the attack in closed chambers. He swore he'd execute his Minister of War, a man already in political trouble after the disastrous Maiden's Pool adventure, if the man hadn't been in the spire when it toppled. His haggard deputy, Viscount Purimar, was now the unfortunate object of Tavard's ire. But only because I wasn't around. I don't know how or why, but Tavard really did blame me for his misfortunes. Despite all argument and evidence to the contrary, apparently, he saw the dragon attack and the assault on the royal palace as being instigated by me. Though he was my liege, he did not address his concerns to me directly. He bellowed them during his small court sessions and screamed them at night in drunken rages. His wishes and comportment came back to me in a dozen quiet ways. I made a point to give Tavard a wide berth for a while. Anguin, on the other hand, had gained considerable esteem among the upper nobility, both for his brave confrontation of Corbal's emissary and for his insistence on leading the courier and passing the king's proposal in emergency session after the attack. Though more than a dozen counts were missing, the rest of the upper nobility now saw the reason behind a more unified defense. They were galvanized by the attack. No one who'd seen the glowing red eyes of the Draugan or witnessed the assault on Castabriel from afar could deny the kingdom was now at war. If the king needed coin for defense, those whose office was charged with that duty would eagerly comply. King Rhard himself was nearly as grief-stricken over the loss of his grandson as Tavard and Darmandra were. Queen Grendine seemed to age 10 years overnight. I attended the funeral. It was a state event. As a member of the royal court, I was obligated to go, but neither Rhard nor Tavard approached me at the ceremony or the reception after, so I left it alone. I was just finishing up a quick meeting with the head of the Arcane Orders about the repairs the headquarters needed after the attack when the Lastian summoned me.
Alia is awake again, she informed me. She's talking. She's talking well, she admitted, and she's famished. I've sent to the castle for food, but we're still in the snowflake chamber.
It's been 3 days. No doubt she's starving. Any significant change?
Yes,
the Lastian said, definitively but without elaboration. When I arrived back at the chamber, I could see why she didn't try to explain it. I'm not certain she could have. Alia was awake again, and she was more alert and responsive than ever. But there was something a little off to her, too, not merely the result of her catastrophic injury, but something else.
Her enneagram is looking a lot better,
Ruderal observed, after I'd made sure she was all right and watched her eat a bowl of stew.
It's still messed up, but it's more regular now, especially in the center.
I didn't know what that meant, but I was sure he did. Her vitals are fine, except for low blood sugar, Lelastian confirmed, as Alia devoured a pigeon pie and a half wheel of cheese.
She's correcting that, quickly. I did a short cognitive assessment. I'd say she's improved a couple of percentage points. Her memory came back a little, too. She mentioned some place called Hawk's Reach.
Her father's dairy in Beauval, I nodded. She misses the cows and the cheese, Ruderal nodded.
It's a long-term memory, and that's fantastic. That might explain why she seems a little different. and it might lead to more. She nearly remembered her children, I think. But I think that whatever the handmaiden did, we should pretend it was an extended treatment. I don't think there was a danger. I feel fine, Alia insisted. I'm sitting right here, you realize. I can hear everything you say. But can you understand it? Not always, she conceded. But did I always understand it before? No, I admitted, but I am glad you are okay. The danger has passed. Has it? She asked, curious. The immediate danger has passed, I corrected. There are still ugly things in the world who want to hurt us. That doesn't seem entirely fair, Alia said philosophically, as she pushed the last spoonful of stew in her mouth. Minilin, were those my children? From a few days ago. Yes, Minalian and Almina. They miss you dearly. I liked them, she decided resolutely. I think I will keep them. They are cute. That's good to know, I agreed seriously. I studied the megalith in its socket on the snowflake while Alia ate more than any time since she was pregnant. I summoned Insight to take a closer look. The Urianites and the crystalline structure of the snowflake seemed to be ignoring each other on an atomic level. I had no idea how I was going to get it out again. Here, girl, I said jokingly, as I beckoned it with a whistle. It worked with my dogs, after all. While I doubt the whistle had anything to do with it, apparently the handmaiden sensed my summons. In a moment, the megalith separated from the snowflake a lot easier than it had the first time. The sphere floated back to its accustomed place, just above eye level, behind my right shoulder, acting like nothing had happened. Are you about ready to take her back to the Tower of Refuge? I asked Lelastian, as I frowned at my magical implement. I want to stay, Alia decided, before the sorceress could answer. I want to stay here in Sevendor. I like it here. It's fun. You think dragon attacks are fun? Asked Ruderol scornfully. Alia shrugged. I have no objections, Lelastian said. Physically, she's fine. Perfectly healthy. Keep up the treatments every day, and I can't think of any reason she should not come home. As long as she is ready, she added, looking at Alia. I'm ready, she agreed confidently. I think. I want to see more. I want to see everything. I'm ready, she stressed. I suppose I am too, I said cautiously. It seemed insane to bring Alia back here to stay after a dragon attack, but then she hadn't been hurt, and hopefully Korbal would reconsider before wasting another dragon on Sevendor. I realized I was just being an anxious husband. All right. I'll have a room made up in Spellmonger's Hall. You can stay there tonight. We'll see about continuing the arrangement as events warrant. That would be wise, Lelastian agreed. You might want to wait a while until you resume full marital relations. What? She asked, when she saw me blush unexpectedly. Don't worry, she's perfectly capable physically. Just be sure she's capable emotionally. It might be a delicate matter for a while. We don't need to rush into anything, I assured her. I think I just need to get to know Alia again and reintroduce her to her home. That's probably the best medicine you can give her, Lelastian agreed, smiling, as Alia went to the next dish on her tray, a cobbler. What's this? Hot fruit? Ooh! Chapter 75. News from Faris. Despite the loss and the damage and destruction in Sevendor and Castabriel, having Alia around again made it hard for me to get depressed. She wasn't the same, of course, especially around the children, but they were adjusting to her new state, as she was adjusting to the idea that she was, in some vague way, responsible and related to them. She had to get used to the idea, for instance, that her name was Alia to everyone else, and Mummy to the children. Minalian was the more suspect of the two. He was old enough to have firm memories of his mother, and while this woman looked, sounded, and smelled like Alia, she wasn't acting like his mummy. That didn't stop him from clinging to her or playing with her. In many ways, this mummy was far more fun and playful than the old one. Almina was more accepting. She couldn't get enough of the attention Alia paid her, and if it differed from the kind of love she expected from her mother, she didn't complain. Apart from me, the person most happy to see her return was her own sister. Alia spent 2 days at Southridge with Ella and Sagal, and the time was productive. Apparently, she had many memories of her, and as fretful as Ella was, she was so grateful to have her sister back that she was more than willing to excuse the strangeness that still affected her. I was glad of the time, myself. As enthralled as I was by having my wife back, in some capacity, time spent with her could be exhausting, too. There was still much she did not understand, not just about social niceties and customs, but about basic matters. Watching Alia was in some ways more exhausting than looking after a toddler. I needed the time, too. The aftermath of the battles of Sevendor and Castavriel were sending ripples through the kingdom, and I needed to address them once I managed the clean-up and recovery of my own lands. Many regions were hastily appointing, or electing, new counts to replace those who fell at the palace. Others were bracing for war. The destruction of the ducal capital forced the remains of the court to return to Wilderhall for the winter, where the infrastructure of administration remained. That included the prince and princess, who shunned the sight of their baby's death. I could not blame them. They certainly blamed me. The first official notice of my actions on the day of the Curia was a letter from Tavard, as Duke of Castile, instructing me to submit a detailed account of my actions that day. I was happy to oblige, and was as forthright as I could be in the 7 pages of parchment I sent back. I heard nothing for weeks. In the meantime, Rad was in a quandary and sent for me for counsel on 2 separate occasions. The first to advise him on what to do with Tavard's 2,000 men in Maiden's Pool, who were stranded there until some rescue could be devised. As they were at risk for capture and enslavement, that was a pressing issue. The second time was concerning new candidates for both Prime Minister and Court Wizard. While Harterian survived his encounter with the Draugen, his wounds were harsh, and he begged leave to retire to his estates in Wenshire. Rad couldn't very well deny the man. He had a permanent wheeze now, from how his crushed ribs had healed, and he insisted he was too emotionally exhausted to perform his duties any more. Rad offered the job to me, of course, but living at the royal palace was the last thing I wanted to do. It also established conflicts of interest, bureaucratically speaking, but the biggest reason was that I didn't want to be in Tavard's proximity and remind him of what he'd lost. As a father, I knew that would be too much to bear. As it was, after I submitted my account to him, all further interactions were done through the Prime Minister. I didn't push the matter. Rad ended up selecting Lord Argus, Kindine's long-time deputy, to act as temporary Prime Minister, and, on my recommendation, took on Master Loico as the new Royal Court Wizard with my hearty recommendation. As loath as I was to lose him as my own, I knew the well-respected Wenshari war mage was the right man to lead the kingdom's magical policies. It meant I was out a baronial court wizard, but even I had to admit that Loico's talents were wasted in that position. I hired Master Thinradl, former ducal court wizard of Alshar, as a temporary appointment a few days later. Thinradl had been jumping from Verone to Rhemir, where he had some allies, doing odd jobs with his witchstone, drinking and enjoying life. With his native land in the hands of rebels, he didn't have much else to do. He had little interest in his estates in the Wilderlands, nor was he a war mage. He had a studious bent and a wry sense of humour, and I think he was looking for something to do. There was another good reason. He was heavily invested in the Arcane Mercantile Company, and found proximity to Sevendor Town's unique market a good way to keep his eye on his investment. As he had a lot of contacts in southern Alshar and Merwin, Bannermore was eager for the new blood. He'd already exhausted Loico's limited number of contacts in Faris and Wenshire. He wanted to expand. Once the new court appointments were settled, in late autumn, things got back to a certain equilibrium. The harvest was in full swing, the damage was being repaired, and most folk were content to grieve their dead quietly, once the visible signs of the battle were removed. In Sevendor, the dragon carcass was removed to the clearing near the Enchanted Forest, where Taran sent a crew to butcher it for parts. I actually got to watch, for a change,
a process that had been developing since the first dead dragon at Castle Cambrian. The hide was worth a fortune in armour, for one thing, and Taran had uses for nearly every organ and bone now. Greenflower had an entire warehouse of dead dragon parts. He showed up himself when his crew cracked the abdominal skin and entered the cavity inside. There was something in particular that Taran wanted.
"The stomach acid," he revealed sheepishly. "It's incredibly powerful and unlike anything I've ever seen. It takes enchanted glass to contain it, but it has some unique properties. Omar and the other alchemists I've consulted are mad for the stuff. With a dragon this size, we can expect 40 or 50 gallons, he said eagerly. That wasn't all that the talented thaumaturge found, as his men sliced through the incredibly dense tissue with magically sharpened blades. As the organs were brought out one by one, weighed and catalogued, a surprise emerged.
"This one is female," Taran said in surprise. "The two we've had before were male."
"Does that make a difference?" I asked, confused. "It's intriguing, a new avenue of study, particularly since she was pregnant and about to lay. There are two eggs in her oviduct. I'm no dragon expert."
"Yes, actually, you are," I countered, "unless you know someone else who knows more about them."
"No one mortal," he grinned. "This one was about to lay. I've dealt with enough undead chickens to know when that's happening. Whoever forced this old girl to fly and fight did her no service," he said, shaking his head. "It was cruel. Those things are huge, about to be laid," he said, as a couple of his men brought the first one out.
"Two of them, too.
That caught me off guard. Are they viable?" Taran shrugged his scrawny shoulders. "How should I know? This is the first female I've ever examined post-mortem. They were somewhat protected from the ice. The oviduct is pretty remote from the lungs. They were still warm," he admitted. "I don't know. Ask the sorceress. This seems to be her sort of thing," he said wearily, smearing dragon slime on his leather apron. "Well, the Alka Alon did originally use dragons during their warring states period," I agreed. "Maybe there is some lore there on their husbandry." It was Taran's turn to be off guard. "You want to raise dragons?" he asked, startled.
"I have 2 dragon eggs,
I shrugged. "I suppose I could make an omelette, but I'm curious."
"You're insane," he affirmed.
"Min, this dragon is only a couple of years old, and it weighs 50 tons. Consider how much protein it must require just to keep it alive. Think of how many helpless prisoners were thrown to it when it was just a baby."
"I'm just thinking about it,"
I said, enjoying his reaction. "But lay them aside and make certain they're protected. They might be the most valuable thing in this carcass." "What do you want me to do with the head?" he asked, nodding toward where a crew surrounded the dead dragon's head and neck, after I removed the brain and such. I considered. "Take it to the tavern, out on the old commons," I decided. The stone building and the tree that had been the first tap house in Sevendor had gotten destroyed in the attack, but within 2 days the proprietor had started serving again in the ruins. People liked to drink. "I want the teeth pulled. It looks like Ruderal earned one."
"And so did you," he pointed out. "You won it fairly."
As it turned out, the skull became a famous point of interest and secured patronage for the place. The valuable teeth were removed, and the largest were cleaned up for presentation. Taran claimed the rest for research, and replaced by shining replicas. The mighty skull was hoisted into the rafters when the tavern was rebuilt around it, festooned with mage lights, and the eyes were replaced by hand-blown snow-glass crystal from the Genli pit glassworks. Not only did they glow at night, but they produced other intriguing but harmless effects for the amusement of the patrons. The tavern was renamed the Drowned Dragon, and featured a wonderfully goofy statue carved of snowstone of a winged worm with its arse in the air and its head under an ever-flowing fountain contrived to look like a keg of ale. It became, with the alembic and the sword and staff, one of Sevendor's signature drinking establishments.
"You know, we'll make almost enough from selling dragon hide to pay for the damage to the town,"
Bannermore informed me one bright autumn afternoon as we passed by the corpse on our way to inspect the repairs to the Bulyutarian's hall. Bannermore had taken the opportunity of the reconstruction to add another story to expand the operation,
and he wanted the builder to know that the spellmonger was paying attention to what was happening. Planners has already sent me an order for 9 square feet of wing material and 6 of belly. Those scales go for 2 roses apiece, he added, his eyes gleaming. I would rather have avoided it, and a pity it interrupted the magic fair.
We'll recover,
he dismissed. If anything, it brought the arcane community closer together. Nothing makes a bird-chested enchanter feel better about his craft than seeing a staff he built in the hands of a war mage saving his ass. And it was entertaining, he added. A real dragon attack. Not many other fairs can boast of such amusements, he said with black humour. The question will be, how will you top it next year? I'm working on it, he sighed. With gods and dragons, giant orcs and giant wyverns to compare to, it's going to require some thought. Not to diminish the tragedy of the situation, he added seriously. I lost good people in the attack. 3 fair wardens and 2 law brothers I miss more than Gareth. But a wise wizard turns tragedy into opportunity, he decided. Now I get to expand the mill pond. Better water supply for the town, and I can dredge some of that silt out. What about the water elemental? He chuckled. Splashy. That's what the kids call him. Rutherol is transferring him to the gap while we're working. He's become quite the celebrity since the slaying. He'll go back in as soon as we refill the pond. The kids love him. We were just leaving the construction site at the Bouliotterion when we ran into Master Thinraddle, who was settling into his new role and familiarizing himself with Sevendor Town. The dapper Alshari mage was delighted at having a post here and praised the amenities of the town to no end. I know Verone is larger and Phallus more cosmopolitan, but there is just something quaint and magical about Sevendor, he decided. Tell me, have you considered some sort of formal apprenticeship program? I've stumbled across potboys with Rajira who are hanging around, just waiting for the chance to get apprenticed. Usually we do a presentation for that sort of thing at the fair, but it was interrupted by a dragon attack, Bannermore admitted. Actually, I remembered, I cut a deal with Count Moran. I have the right to start 3 new magical academies. One of them should be here. Oh, that would be magnificent, Thinraddle agreed happily. Of course, one would have to find a place to put it. What about Brestol Tower once it's rebuilt? Bannermore proposed. It's not really good for much else right now. You have better prison facilities in the mountain. Most of the garrison is housed at the Dyke Town or the Gatehouse, and it's not really guarding anything. Waste of a facility, he concluded. It would be enough for a start, Thinraddle agreed. Perhaps next spring we can select a preliminary class. But I've seen the site. We might want to make some adjustments before it is rebuilt, he said tactfully. Of course, the entire place will need to be redesigned, Bannermore agreed. I think we can come up with some funding for that. That will make my tenure here complete, Thinraddle said happily. There aren't too many dream jobs left to add to my body of work. Founding fellow of a magical academy would fit nicely, though. Can I buy you gentlemen a drink? He asked as we approached the alembic. Perhaps we can discuss potential faculty. Things were better in Sevendor by late autumn. In some ways, they were better than they'd ever been. Between the divine visitation in the spring and the dragon attack in the autumn, the amount of construction and commerce in the domain created more than enough opportunities for the peasants, bereft of harvesting opportunities, to pick up coin to pay their rents, and then some. Alia and the children were on good terms, although her strange behaviour still made them uncomfortable sometimes. Thankfully, the Tal Alon staff at Spellmonger's Hall were ecstatic to have their lady back, and they waited on her diligently. If they noticed any difference to her, they didn't mention it. Her sister and mine, however, were still concerned about her differences. She's just not Alia, Ella declared, when they cornered me at the high table in the Great Hall for breakfast one morning that autumn. Not really. I mean, she looks and sounds like Alia, and she still remembers a few things. But her personality is different. She's odd, Ura agreed. Not in a scary way, usually, but there's something off about her, Min. I know you love her, she said sympathetically, but I hope you realize she's not really back.
I took her down to the market with the kids yesterday, and she had some sort of attack because of all the people. She's not back yet, she repeated.
Not yet, I agreed. But she's still taking daily treatments with the handmaiden, and now that she's using the snowflake to reintegrate her, the healing is going even faster.
I don't know about all that magic stuff, Alice said distastefully, but she's still not right.
Give it time, my ladies, I urged. The fact that she's alive and speaking at all is a goddamned miracle. I don't expect to be able to put her back exactly the way she was. I'll settle for what I can get. I suggest you do as well, I added.
Sister Bemio was more hopeful. She'd agreed to monitor Alia Philolastian, once the sorceress taught her how, and report if there was any dramatic change in her condition. That level of attention allowed her a more realistic idea of how she was progressing, and she saw plenty of room for hope. I was gratified to see that Lady Estret, one of Alia's closest friends, was always cheerful when she regarded her. She took a little time out of her day each day to sit with Alia in the courtyard of the castle, drink tea or wine, and just converse. It became one of Alia's favourite parts of the day.
My lord, I believe the effort was worthwhile, Sire Kay told me, as we watched them from the top of my tower one afternoon, as Lady Estret struggled to see if Alia's condition had improved her embroidery at all. From the looks of dismay, it didn't look like it had. Some things are beyond the realm of even magic to repair.
Well, it probably helps her develop her hand-eye coordination, but honestly, she has no talent for it, I sighed, enjoying the sight.
My lord jests, Sire Kay chuckled. I meant the raid on Olum Seheri, the descent into darkness, into the very halls of the dead. You contended with the darkest force in the land, and claimed what you needed to restore your heart's desire. No better story was ever told by a bard. You need to find better bards. It was an act of desperation that got a lot of people killed, upended the political order of the kingdom, again, and was of dubious military value. I could feel Sire Kay's disapproving eyes on the back of my neck, and feel him take a breath to defend me. He was just like that. That being said, I continued, laying aside the completely selfish desire to restore my wife's mind, the rest of the endeavour had merit. We got Radin back. A better Radin, I added. Come next spring, they'll be wed, and Dalshal will have a viable dynasty again. That's a good thing, I said hesitantly. Though I am suspect of the princess's character, I agree that His Grace seems pleased with the match, he sighed. If she proves loyal, she could be a valuable asset to the realm. Speaking of which, he said, remembering something, this arrived for you this morning by mirror array, he said, removing a scroll from his belt. I thought I'd bring it to you directly. It was an invitation to a celebration of Radin and Angwin's impending nuptials, for a date 2 weeks hence. It was hosted by House Furtius, specifically Lady Gatina the Kitten, as a fete by the Alshari nobility in support of the Union. It was to be a small affair in a surprise location, she wrote, with Magi available to transport the invitees to the formal event. A bridal shower? From the Magi? I asked skeptically. She is a lady of the Alshari court, Sire Kay reminded me. Her father is counted as one of Angwin's most influential, unofficial advisers now, after whatever he managed to do to convince King Rad to permit the union, and Sir Artapol is one of His Grace's friends as well. I suppose they're entitled, I sighed. Though what quaint little grotto in Verone she found for it, I don't know. Girls seem to love their secrets and their parties. Please let her know that Alia and I will be thrilled to attend, I said, handing the scroll back to him. That should give me some time to enchant some suitable gifts, too, I considered. What do you get a ruthless lord of assassins marrying an ambitious duke? I would not expect His Highness to be in attendance, Sire Kay suggested somberly. Rumour is that he is ill-disposed to his cousin and his sister after the loss of the heir. I wouldn't expect him to be, I agreed, but I'm sure he'll send some suitably insulting gift. So far, he hasn't shown much sign of taking revenge on me for whatever it was I was supposed to have done. I'm hoping his father's wiser head prevails. There is little he can do legally,
Sayaka pointed out encouragingly. You were acting as a member of the royal court, not the ducal court. You were not acting in your capacity as Tavard's vassal. I defy any court of justice to find fault with your actions, my lord, he assured. This is about politics, not the law. Politics and resentment. He still hasn't found a way to rescue his expeditionary force from Maiden's Pool, and he's trying to deal with a grieving, pregnant wife. That has to be a lot of pressure. But I don't think he's going to give up on his enmity for me. He's placed me under house arrest before. He could do so again with a single order.
This is not so bad a place to be internally exiled to, he pointed out, as Estret laughed good-naturedly at some mistake of Alia's. It's no Tower of Despair.
It wasn't. It was Sevendor Castle, my home. It felt like a home again, with Alia back, in whatever fashion. I thought of Lord Eratas and his wife, locked eternally in a cavern with each other. I was almost envious. I would give up all my titles and even magic itself to spend such a time with my wife. At least that's what I thought in that moment. 10 days later, a second message came through the mirror array that night, sent from Ilunabar on the old Castali coast. The old port city was one of the latest in the network of mirror sites, largely at Bannermore's urging. He liked to compare the commodity prices at the dock there and compare them to his Rumiran reports. The message was from Mudrost, the sea mage, which got my attention at once.
My masters were pleased with the result of our last bargain, and seek to secure this substance in greater abundance. Be advised to expect me in the spring, to negotiate a more permanent agreement.
That was it. Nor was there any way to contact him. Sea Magi seemed to thrive on such cryptic ways. That made me concerned for a number of reasons. The introductory sale had made me the wealthiest man in the world, so wealthy that Bannermore assured me I could not spend it all without wiping out the economy of all 5 duchies. I had no more need for gold, nor did I have too many more mountains of snowstone just laying around. It was a finite commodity, and while I was pleased that the Vundle found favor with it, too much of Sevendor was sitting on top of it to make it easily saleable. But could I really refuse? Knowing what I knew now, the Vundle were the supreme rulers on Kalador. They could scrape us off like so much manure from their metaphorical shoe. Telling them no, however politely, when they had expressed interest in our race for the first time since our settlement, didn't seem terribly wise. It was a dilemma. The only real solution to selling Sevendor, or being removed from Sevendor, was to figure out how Snowstone was made in the first place, and repeat the feat. Dunsellan had been doing research in that area, I knew, though I was loath to explore the notes his dark mind left behind. But the simple message from a sea mage served to radically alter my priorities. Finding out that he was returning this spring for more, and was unlikely to take no for an answer, vaulted the matter to the top of my list. I was still musing on it the next morning when I got the emergency summons to court, the royal court, in my capacity as head of the Arcane Orders. Master Loico made the request mind to mind, right after breakfast, and brought me through the ways an hour later. It turned out to be an emergency council, called by Lord Argas, the acting Prime Minister on Rad's behalf. Rad was present, looking highly irritated. Loico Vanaren was there, looking more comfortable in his robes of office than I would have anticipated. The new Minister of War, Count Mendeku of Aurera, was there as well, and a few sea lords in their court gear. Count Mendeku was from the southeastern region of Castal, just north of Relan Kor, and had a powerful reputation as a war leader. He was an older gentleman with a strong military bearing. I'd heard both Count Salgo and Master Loico speak highly of him. His selection was a tangible sign that Rad was taking the war with Korbal seriously. But there was little to indicate that this council concerned the West. I was the only mage present, save for Loico, the new court wizard, for one thing. Neither Telemann or Mavone, who was in the region, were present. I was confused until Lord Argas announced the subject of the meeting. This morning these gentlemen brought word from the west, he said with a resigned sigh, as he nodded toward the sea lords. The south-west, not Ulam Saheri, he explained. The Alshari Armada is headed back to Anultramar after a very fruitful season of piracy and slaving. But while they were gone, he continued, irritated, apparently a small fleet of those who returned early from the season was hired by the remaining censors living in the Tower of Sorcery, in Phallus. 9 ships, 4 of them an organized fleet hired as auxiliaries. Yesterday, at dusk, they sailed into the unguarded harbour of Pharis. With the aid of some local mercenaries, they took the entire city.
Wait. What?
I asked, my jaw agape.
We just lost Pharis? Duin's Harry's sack. To the remnants of the censorate,
Loco agreed grimly. That is why you were summoned. Details are still sketchy and brief, but it appears that they had an advanced plan to subvert the city, and did so by stealth. When Prince Tavard stripped the native defences away, it was a golden opportunity to act, just as their welcome in Alshar was wearing thin. They announced the change of rule this morning from the Doge's old palace. They raised the checkered banner over it. He said darkly, another flies from the Mad Mage's palace, under the banner of House Pratt. The thought of either sinister banner hanging anywhere made any honest wizard's skin crawl.
But why would they do something like that?
Rod asked in angry disbelief.
Perhaps because they could, my liege.
The Minister of War pointed out dryly, without their harbour defences, there was little Pharis could do to repel the invaders before they landed,
and once they did, they had magic and allies to aid them. Witch stones, taken from the Censorate's vaults.
The Censorate had been confiscating stray bits of Irionite for 4 centuries. We'd liberated a cache from the citadel in Wenshar after the expulsion. While they were generally poorer in quality than the stones we'd acquired since, they were still Irionite. They still granted the power of the High Magi, against which even trained War Magi were powerless. Reports said they had at least 5, and perhaps as much as 9 shards. That would be more than sufficient to do it, I reasoned. Pharis is remote from the 5 duchies, and Castelshar in particular, I agreed. With Korbal seeking to enslave anyone with talent, and plenty of agents in an ultramar, they probably felt endangered there.
Serves the bastards right,
muttered Loico. This is more dangerous than you suspect, Your Majesty. He continued, the libraries and resources of Pharis are massive.
The Mad Mage and the other Pharisi Magi enjoyed relative freedom to practice their art without the censorate for centuries. They amassed a considerable volume of pre-conquest lore. If they succeed in establishing themselves, they could make it quite difficult to dislodge them. It was hard enough to do so with the Mad Mage, and he had but 1 shard of Irionite. The censors have 6, perhaps more.
And we have scores, I pointed out. This is a setback, but not insurmountable.
I leave the place alone for a year, and it goes to 6 hells,
sighed Loico, rolling his eyes.
This is disturbing news,
Rod agreed, his brow furrowed.
I had hopes to launch a rescue mission from Pharis to Maidenspool and deliver those poor men before they were captured and enslaved. Now that's going to be impossible.
It's more than disturbing. It's near disastrous, fumed Grendine, entering the room with a sheaf of parchment in hand. The conquest of Pharis was the cornerstone for the effort to found the kingdom. It was Kindine's signature policy initiative that prepared the way to establish the crown. 3 years he negotiated to bring about that invasion. I thank the gods he perished before he saw it brought to naught.
How did they manage to get a fleet? Asked the Prime Minister, Argus.
I thought the Armada had brought all the Alshari ships out to raid.
Some of the raiders came back early, loaded with slaves and plunder. Loico replied, one of them was more eager for what the censorate offered than more raiding. A witchstone, the nephew of Oril Pratt. He used his fleet of 4 ships to make the raid in exchange for a moderately sized shard of Irionite from their stores, restoration of his uncle's palace, and promise of a position in the new regime. Likely a prominent one, considering his relation to the Mad Mage. He still enjoys a certain pride and respect among the natives.
I recall. I nodded. He was a fallen hero among the resistance during the occupation, and from what Tyndall and Rondal had told me, Pratt the younger was as twisted as his uncle, with a penchant for piracy for good measure.
So, what are we going to do?
There's no guarantee they will be successful in holding the city, my lords,
counseled one of the Sea Lords. There are still 3,000 royal troops garrisoned there, and not all of them have been captured. There are also plenty of loyalists among the population, particularly the mercantile class. It is likely that the people will not be happy about having the censorate in charge, he predicted.
Why is no one holding His Highness to account about this loss?
One of the Sea Lords asked.
Begging your pardon, my liege, but he used your name to snake the harbour defences away. I and most of the garrison. If one was to lay blame for this loss, I will hold my son accountable for this,
Rad promised. He and I are negotiating on an appropriate recompense. I imagine this alters that negotiation. What do the Alshari rebels think of the development? Asked the Minister of War, changing the subject quickly.
I doubt they've even heard of it yet,
the Sea Lord replied.
Those who aren't out to sea are seeing to the last of the harvest. There won't be a convention until this autumn, when the fleet returns and the harvest is in.
As to their position on the matter,
the other older mariner suggested,
I would imagine that seeing Faris out of Castelshari hands is a boon, regardless of who took it away from us. It's possible that they will extend aid and recognition to them.
They've been lurking about in Phalas for years, sucking up to the Five Counts.
They likely are allies. Even if they did not provide direct aid, they might blockade the city against us just out of spite.
That's cheery news,
Lyko said gloomily. Actually, it is, I pointed out. The censorate provided the rebels with a mask of legitimacy, as well as expert advice in arcane matters. Most of the other magi in and Ultramar are against the council, or at most ambivalent about it. They've lost their pet magi.
What about magic? Grendine asked. Can you not send troops there that way?
There are no natural waypoints in the city, from what I understand,
Lyko admitted. That doesn't mean we can't act, I pointed out. We have our ways.
I thought the arcane orders didn't get involved in that sort of political thing,
Grendine chided. Alshar is a different matter. This isn't a local rebellion. This is a coup d'etat against royal authority by magical means. The involvement of the censorate means that we are obligated to assist. Besides, I added, there's no fucking way I'm marching down that entire peninsula again, I said. I wasn't joking. We'll be able to at least get a few agents and assassins in. Give us 6 months and we can probably stage an insurrection.
You give me that, I'll get you the assassins,
Grendine promised.
That would be cheaper than mounting another invasion, particularly without the Alshari fleet,
agreed Count Mendeku. I wish there was some way to get the army at Maidenspool to march on Faris, he said, envisioning the strategy in his mind. Master Lyko beat me to it.
No, the western side of the peninsula is far less accommodating than the east, else we would have launched the original invasion from Alshar, not Castal. Send those men south and you send them to a quick death, he warned. We will have to rely on clandestine strategy for now,
Rad decided, but I do not like the looks of this, my friends. First the Westlands, then Sevendor and Castabriel. Now Faris, I fear our kingdom is fraying at the edges, he said, deeply troubled. I spent a few moments speaking with Lyko after the briefing. We figured out a way to transport a waystone to Faris, using the wizard trading company agent there and a shared Hoxter pocket. Lyko was eager to assist. He seemed personally insulted by his former territory being ruled by the censorate.
I will destroy them myself if they molest the arcane library there, he promised me.
Oril Pratt had works on his shelves thought lost in the conquest. It was a boon to even see them.
Did you chance to study there?
I wasn't able to read them, I pointed out. I wasn't in the officer corps. I was putting down insurrection, beating the resistance, and killing undead in the streets. How is the new position treating you?
It's more involved than being your court wizard,
he decided. Rad knows me, but he doesn't really trust me yet. He's still stricken over Kindine and his grandson. So is Grendine. But this is the third emergency meeting of this sort this week.
You never put me through such trials,
he teased gently. "You should demand more money," I advised.
"Stay for luncheon," he asked. "The kitchens are quite good here."
"Alas, I cannot," I sighed. "I have many duties to attend to, not the least of which is to prepare Alia and me for a bridal shower. It's her first official court function since she fell ill."
"It ought to be exciting," I smiled.
"For a bridal shower."
Chapter 76. A Ducal Bridal Shower.
"Do I have to wear this?" Alia complained, as we waited for the rest of our party in the Great Hall. She was wearing one of her simpler court gowns, one she'd had made after we were made Baron and Baroness. It was a perfectly nice blue gown in the Riverlord style, and one she'd expressed fondness for before her accident. Now she was unenthusiastic about it.
"It itches."
"You sound like Manalion," I chuckled. "It's not even enchanted. And all court finery itches. That's kind of the point."
"I don't understand this at all," Alia said, frustrated. "This is just a party."
"It's a party for our friends," I countered. "You like parties?"
"I do like parties,"
she agreed, considering the matter.
"But itchy parties?"
"It's a different kind of party than the fair," I explained. "Just, it's different," I said lamely. "Sometimes it's more important for us to be there for our friends than it is to be concerned with our own comfort." I'd had a similar discussion with Manalion about wearing hose like a big boy once the weather changed.
"And Anguin is a friend of ours," she stated. "I like him."
"Yes, you do," I agreed patiently. "So you want him to have a good time, which means you have to put up with an itchy gown for a while. I could use magic on it," I added. Alia was a bit suspicious of magic, or anything she didn't fully understand. When she realized that the dough proofing at the bakery was actually getting bigger, as we talked to my brother-in-law on a visit the other day, she panicked and insisted that we were under attack by living blobs of dough.
"What about Radin? Do we like her?" she asked.
"We're open to liking her," I decided, "but we should pretend to like her anyway."
"Why?"
she demanded. "Because it's polite, and it would hurt Anguin's feelings if we didn't."
"Oh,"
Alia said, pursing her lips judgmentally.
"This is harder than I thought."
"You'll get used to it," I promised. "I'll try to make sure you have fun somehow. But if you could just bear the discomfort and the long, boring speeches and such, I would certainly appreciate it."
"All right,"
she sighed, as if she were doing me a great boon.
"I suppose."
"You are my husband?" she affirmed. "Yes, I am," I agreed. Thankfully, Sayake and Lady Estret arrived, looking splendid in their own finery, and kept me from having to explain, again, just what that meant. Behind them was Dara in her beautiful hawk cloak, looking distant and sullen and prettier than usual for some reason. She had made some effort to forgive me for interfering in her life, but she still held a grudge. I felt bad about that, but sometimes you had to intervene in someone's life, even at the risk of a friendship, if wisdom dictated it.
"Everyone looks so beautiful,"
Lady Estret assured, looking at each of us in turn.
"Alia, your gown is so striking."
"Thank you,"
she said very seriously.
"It makes my boobs itch."
"Let me take a look, my lady," Estret said, pulling her toward the chapel, where they could have some privacy.
"Perhaps you did not fasten it properly."
"Is this whole affair really necessary?" demanded Dara crossly.
"Duke Anguin has always been a friend to Sevendor," Sayake reproved. "He is a gentleman and a worthy liege. You should be honored to be included in his private celebrations, Lady Lenadara."
She frowned, but she didn't argue further. Part of her discomfort was the news that the Alshari wing, captained by the Kasari girl Natia, had relocated her riders to Timberwatch, permanently. She was not coming back to Sevendor, and neither were her birds. That had put my apprentice in a mood. Dara knew she was behaving poorly. It seemed to be the last vestiges of the teenaged girl leaving her in favor of the more serious perspective of a young woman. Sayake has that effect on you.
"What gift do you bring Minilin?"
Kay asked, curious. "Estret and I are giving them the traditional 7 bottles of mead from Cargwinian's meadery, and 200 weights of the finest honey."
dragonhide armour for His Grace, I said. I had Tyndall take his measurements, and Taran has been labouring for a week to get it done, with the antlers and anchor burned into the breastplate with acid. For Her Highness, I continued, a selection of amulets designed to assist her in her unofficial duties. The long ears spell, perception and deception enchantments, everything an ambitious young assassin and spy lord might need.
That seems an unusual wedding gift, Minilin.
Kay frowned. She's not your basic bride, I countered. I'm no great admirer of her methods, but I am wise enough to know that such methods are often required by those who rule. Anguin would be poorly served by someone of lesser talents in that position. It's not chivalrous, I admit.
As Her Highness is no knight, she is under no obligation to chivalry,
Sire Kay conceded. Yet I do hope she stays her deadly hand in Alshar. My poor duchy has suffered so much already. It needs to lose no more. She's not bloodthirsty, just practical, and ruthless, I conceded. In Anguin's current position, he will need both.
I understand. I just dislike it.
There are times I feel the world would be better if it were governed by knights and ruled by chivalry, and then there are times that I realize that such rule would taint the very idea of chivalry.
So, do we even know where we're going?
Asked Dara abruptly. I know it's Alshar, but what part? It's a surprise, I said apologetically, as Estret and Alia came back from the chapel, giggling. I really have no idea. We should be getting word of what to do at any time, though.
I hope it isn't cold,
grumbled Dara. I'm really not dressed for that.
You're a wizard. You can make adjustments. I'm certain it is just some entertaining little Five Rivers estate that Lady Gatina decided was adequate to celebrate His Grace's nuptials, suggested Sire Kay.
There are many such little lodges situated near waterfalls, grottos, caverns, and other natural oddities around Verone, he explained. If charm had a price at market, Verone would have a monopoly.
It should be interesting,
Lady Estret agreed, taking her husband's arm. I know Lady Gatina only a little, but she seems a lady of great intelligence and wit, and terribly devoted to Sir Andal, she added.
Devoted? I snorted. More like obsessed. If throwing a party for his liege will make Rondal like her more, then she'll make it the best party in history to catch his fancy.
Never underestimate what a girl will go through to impress a boy, I said, glancing involuntarily toward Dara. Master? Someone asked me mind to mind. Tyndall, I realized.
Yes.
We're ready when you are. Come through on my personal waystone, he suggested.
All right,
I said after a pause. Tyndall says they're ready.
Shall we?
It doesn't itch as bad anymore,
Alia said, nodding. I'll take that as a yes. Taking four other people through the ways would have been a struggle if I hadn't had the immense power of the megalith and the paracletian of the handmaiden to help. But we transitioned smoothly and found ourselves in a painfully ornate chamber a moment later, along with Tyndall. Nor were we alone. There were at least 30 people in the lavishly decorated chamber. I recognized several from previous occasions. Alshari courtiers, Count Markadine, Baron Asterol, Baron Gideon, Pentandra and Arborn, Viscountess Thrianus and Count Angriel. Anguin's sisters, Lenara and Andine, were in beautiful festival gowns in the house colors for the occasion and were being shepherded by Landfather Amos. Even Lady Pleasure, smirking up a storm in her guise as Baroness Amandice, had been invited. That alone made me suspicious. I wasn't certain if the Baroness was currently the avatar of Ishii, but any time she was around, I got nervous. There was a startled murmur from the assembled when everyone saw Alia. Her slow recovery was not general knowledge, and her sudden appearance caused a great deal of surprise. Alia took it in stride, waving weakly to everyone and nodding when people called her name. She took my arm protectively, and I was gratified to see Lady Estret take her other hand. I could tell she was nervous. She didn't remember most of those who were excited to see her.
Master!
Tyndall exclaimed joyfully.
My lady, I'm so happy to see you looking hale.
And we are properly intrigued by this amusement, Sir Tyndall, said Sire Kay, bowing. Am I to understand that you are party to the secret?
Only recently, I'm afraid,
he admitted.
We were included in the planning very late. Not that Rundle or my efforts were required for such an elaborate celebration, he added cryptically. Lady Gatina is uncommonly suited to seeing such an entertainment plotted from beginning to end, as you shall see.
I am as curious as anyone,
Pentandra said eagerly. She consulted me early in the process for ideas, but I'm really eager to see what she has contrived. Is it a little warm in here? She asked, plucking at her mantle.
I know only that Lady Gatina has asked a few strange favours from me, and no more, admitted Arborn. I have no idea what she's planning.
I'm wondering where we are, exactly, Lady Estret said excitedly. I do love a good surprise party. Magic makes everything a little better, and this chamber is lovely.
It's not Sealgar Lodge,
Landfather Amos said, referring to the estate Anguin was using as a temporary capital in the Wilderlands after the destruction of his palace. Not enough stuffed and mounted trophies, for one thing. I just came from there. From the decor, it's late period El Shari, probably around the time of the Black Duke, the court chaplain reported. It bears the mark of his first wife. There are few such places in the Wilderlands. That narrows the location. Before we could sort out exactly which little estate around Verone we were in, propriety kept me from using magic to determine our location. That would ruin the surprise. Our hostess appeared through the ways, along with a dark-haired older woman and her father. A moment later, Radin and Anguin appeared with Rondal.
My lords and ladies,
Gatina began, looking incredibly delicate and feminine in her black gown, with her white hair spilling over her left shoulder in a delightful cascade. She wore an elaborate silver brooch in the shape of a cat, the eyes of polished onyx.
Your Highness, Your Grace, Your Excellencies,
the beautiful young woman continued in a very theatrical voice. I welcome you to this quiet, intimate celebration of Radin and Anguin's approaching wedding. May Ishi and Trig bless their holy union and let it serve as a beacon of prosperity and abundance for all, she said, to the cheers of all. I know you are all wondering just what amusing little entertainment I have in store for you, in token of this celebration, Gatina continued, clearly enjoying the attention. If you will follow me, I will be happy to relate the details as we travel. As this celebration is sponsored by my own humble house, I present my father, Lord Hans, and my mother, Lady Minorial, as my co-hosts, she continued, opening up a great double door. Please follow us as we lead you to the evening's entertainment. When I considered what gift my proud but humble house could consider giving our noble duke, she said, as she led the crowd down the wide corridor, I was perplexed. We are not as wealthy as a great house, nor is our contribution to the duchy measured in lands and estates. Our contributions tend to be more subtle in nature, she said, with a bow to her father. But, that being said, subtlety can be a profound thing, my lords and ladies, when used with wit and discretion. When I searched my intelligence and took counsel to discover an appropriately noble gift, the one thing I knew my liege desires above all others was the obvious choice.
But I have met my beloved wife already, Lady Gatina, Anguin said innocently. What else could I desire above that? It was a kind of witty banter that is the lifeblood of court. Of course, it elicited an appropriate titter from the crowd. One does not fail to acknowledge the public flirting of one's liege.
A noble secondary desire, then, Your Grace, Gatina conceded with a curtsy to the princess. One would never deny Ishi her primacy in any young man's heart. For those unaware, she continued without a stumble, my ancestors were great collectors. House Furtius has a reputation for acquiring certain items of a rare and precious nature. Could it, mayhap, steal away with the one thing I knew Anguin prized on the occasion of his betrothal?
She was a good orator, I realized, able to spin a captivating tale with her voice and mannerisms. She coaxed every nuance of meaning from every word that escaped her lips, targeting them like arrows against the noble crowd. Young, striking Gatina had everyone enthralled as she led us toward the distant doors down the corridor. We barely knew where we were.
I set my mind to see it done.
Once I made the decision to attempt it, I hired the right retainers to assist, took counsel amongst the wisest people I knew, and enlisted the assistance of my beloved mother and noble father, she continued, with slight bows to both. They seemed to be in on the surprise. It took months of planning and no small expense. Yet no expense was too great to honour our noble duke, she said, as she beckoned us onward. I hired 800 brave men, fresh from Sir Tyndall and Sir Rondell's trials at Timberwatch, to assist in the task, she reported. That was news. What did she need trained troops for? A particularly contentious trousseau? 800 favours for the party were commissioned from the elite enchanters of Sevendor. 800 bronze collars. Slave collars, she continued dramatically. Slave collars, my lady? Viscountess Thrianus asked distastefully. Just what manner of festivity is this? I was starting to wonder myself. Aye. Collars of bronze indicating the basest servitude, the kind imposed at the point of a sword and endorsed by the hated five counts, she agreed sorrowfully. Is that really in the best of taste, my dear? Thrianus asked sceptically. My lady shall be the judge, Lady Gatina promised, unconcerned. These collars were especially prepared, as were their bearers, for all 800 brave warriors of the Wilderlands volunteered to honour their duke by voluntarily adopting the hated things, for they had enlisted in Prince Tavard's expedition to Analtramar, she continued, though that was not their destination. Each man knew full well the fate that awaited him and the deprivations he would have to endure for the honour of Alshar. All were willing to sacrifice their freedom and dignity for the task when it was explained to them. Dear gods, what did you have them do? Lady Pleasure asked, scandalized. You shall see, my lady, Gatina continued, unconcerned. The captains of the ships they embarked upon knew well what the task was to be, for though they took sail in service to His Highness, they knew well the dangers they faced, and could be counted upon in their treachery and mercenary spirit to betray their passengers, change their sails, and sell them into bondage, she said, her violet eyes wide and affecting alarm. Alas, it was an indignity that could not be avoided, she said sorrowfully. These brave scions of the Wilderlands were sold, my lords and ladies, sold at market like cattle or pigs. Their heavy bronze collars marked them as abject slaves. The arms that had been strengthened to bear a sword in defence of the Wilderlands were sold to be worked to death in the worst conditions a mortal can consider outside of Olam Saheri. In lots of 100, they were parcelled out of the holds of the treacherous captain ships and disposed of at the auctioneer's blocks in Analtramar. Before another day passed, they were forced to row their barges upriver to the vast, empty estates of the Alshari interior. The farms desperately needed labour for the harvest, she explained. Our poor Wilderlords were doing work done for centuries by the honest peasants and villeins of Alshar. But the policies of the Five Counts made such traditions too expensive, when slave labour was so cheap. They rowed themselves upriver to estates in Phallus, in Reims, in Erona and Rouen, in Chamhaen and in distant Cofremal. Every master who took in the well-muscled slaves counted himself fortunate, she continued, as if entertaining in a tavern. They seemed docile. They were obedient. They hurried to obey and seemed eager to prove their worth. The masters toasted their close relationship to the Five Counts that enabled them a prime spot at the slave auctions. Even in distant Rhydragrian and Chamhaen, most northerly of the rebel baronies, the need for labour was great enough to merit the purchase of 50 stout slaves, newly taken and proven. For days they laboured, until the last full moon of summer shone. Then every man who was hired saw his collar fall from his neck in one night. Every man who risked his honour and life for his duke discovered the enchantment on the collar. For when the time was right, each one manifested from a huckster implanted within his armour his weapons and other supplies. There was a murmur in the crowd as the implications became clear. In one stroke, at one time, all over southern Alshar, the clandestine warriors were both freed from their bondage and provided with arms and instruction. They immediately seized their master's strongholds, and in one case, far to the north, where 200 strong Wilderlords were sold to the Baron of Rhydragrian,
The men did more. They seized the fortress of Gettamore from the rebel garrison and opened the great gates. Outside the gates, far from the north, was a company of Alshari commandos sent by His Grace to range south of the Land of Scars, led by Count Salgo, the ducal minister of war. He was invited to take possession of the complex in His Grace's name 5 days ago.
That was a stunning development. The security of southern Alshar, including that of the 5 counts, was dependent upon control of the mountain cavern fortress known as Gettamore. There was no other way between Alshar and the rest of the 5 duchies, save by sea. Control of that stronghold was absolutely essential to the viability of the rebellion. And now they'd lost it. It was in the hands of Count Salgo, and I knew he'd defend it to the last.
Count Salgo and his commandos were only too happy to reclaim a secure piece of His Grace's legacy,
Gattina continued as she walked.
Indeed, they secured the fortress and imprisoned the rebels, allowing the Wilderlords to join their fellow escapees downriver. At Vaness, a surprise attack captured the wicked Baron of Ridragrian. The neighbouring barony of Shamhain rose in support of the restoration after its wicked baron was overthrown and sent men to join the uprising. Downriver, at Inmar, the sudden seizure of key facilities on the river from the rebels allowed the barges bearing the Wilderlords to sail south, gathering men and allies, and suddenly attacking those most closely tied to the 5 counts. Thankfully, someone was wise enough to have the foresight to compile lists of the loyal, the disloyal, and the ambivalent before the fateful raid,
she said, taking a small bow.
When the Wilderlord's flotilla passed a town, they arrested the rebels, raised the loyalists to power, and gathered yet more troops. Elsewhere, similar sparks of rebellion to the rebels was brewing. The Wilderlord's slaves around Rouen rose up and seized the small garrison there, before securing the docks on the river and the support of many local lords who have bristled at the traitor's rule. At Arada, local loyalists and Wilderlord agents attacked the rebels' chief agent in that country and ensured that the flotilla could pass. In Rada, the Wilderlords were awaiting transfer to estates in Reims, but instead slew their captors and opened the citadel there to loyalists prepared and waiting. My lady, do you mean to say that you have begun a rebellion in southern Alshar?
Princess Rardine asked skeptically.
If your highness will patiently await the conclusion of my tale, she will see,
Gattina said mischievously.
For the policies of the 5 counts have grown increasingly unpopular with both the people and the nobility, and there have been murmurings of discontent with their rule. Many houses disapproved of the rebellion in the first place, favouring the ducal house, and were willing to pledge their steel to the matter. A little persuasion, a little support, a little preparation, and when the banner of restoration was raised in the north, the loyalists were tasked with overwhelming the rebels in a well-planned, strategic manner. Within days, most of the land north of Rouen was under loyalist control, and a good portion of the lands betwixt Rouen and Fallas were falling. Those rebels who sought to put down the rebellion found their troop movements blocked by failed bridges, guarded roads, and castles held against them. The Wilderlords gathered their strength as they descended the Mandros, collecting more of their comrades and hundreds of loyal Alshari as they went. A series of loyalist raids across the coastal lands followed, and when the unprepared garrisons of the rebels tried to respond, they found themselves locked within their own castles. The loyalists permitted the Wilderlords to descend the escarpment from the highlands, and a mere 2 days ago, she finished, as she triumphantly threw open the ornate double doors, they seized control of the capital of Fallas and imprisoned the rebel leaders here.
What? Anguin snapped.
Here? We're in Fallas?
He asked in disbelief. What better location to celebrate your impending nuptials, Your Grace? Sir Attapal spoke for the first time. Is it not your ancestral home, Your Grace? Your legacy?
Sir Attapal, where exactly are we?
Demanded his friend, Duke Anguin. I bid you welcome to Velsignal Hall, chamber of discussion among the Alshari nobility, and traditional venue for the ducal house to make important announcements to the population, he added. It has been recently cleansed, and comes complete with 300 loyalist knights guarding its every entrance for the occasion, he said.
as he dramatically thrust open the double wooden doors, and we entered the great chamber. We were standing in an ornate gallery above the floor, and a wave of noise arose as we arrived. Hundreds of Al-Shari nobles were gathered beneath the great arched roof. They all started cheering the moment we entered. Anguin looked completely astounded at the roar of applause.
"Your realm is restored to you, Your Grace,"
Katina finished with a simple curtsy. "The palace at Phallus is under our control, as are the major castles along the Mandros. Even now our agents are seizing the docks against the return of the fleet, while pockets of resistance remain. When it became clear that the uprising was viable, many of the uncommitted were eager to lend their support to the cause."
This is astounding,"
Anguin said, as hundreds continued to cheer his name.
You orchestrated a rebellion in my own lands? Without telling me?"
the orphan duke asked Sir Natopol incredulously.
"It seemed improper to reveal the scheme until it had succeeded, Your Grace," the Shadow Mage explained. "Considering how invested you were in the raids against our true foes, it seemed the least we could do to help out in Al-Shar. Did we not say that House Fertius was at your service?" he asked proudly.
"My children are impetuous, Your Grace,"
Lord Hans said, putting his hands on Gatina's shoulders.
"But they are not reckless. My wife, Lady Menurial, oversaw many of Gatina's plans. Once it became clear she had a viable solution to the problem of the rebels, we were happy to put the resources of our house to the task. As it turns out, my house has a lot of resources.
And a lot of friends," Tyndall broke in, looking ridiculously satisfied with himself. "After Ron and I wrecked a good deal of the Mandros last year, things were getting progressively worse for both commoner and noble under the rebel counts. Add in the outbreak of undead in Karamas, the economic recession caused by the crisis, and there were a lot of ears hungry for what Katina and her family were whispering. Sneaking the Wilderlords in with their weapons, hidden inside their very slave collars, was masterful," he said admiringly.
"The problem has always been that the rebels were able to watch those suspected of staging an uprising closely,"
Lord Hans agreed.
"With a military force they weren't aware of, suddenly arising behind their lines. That allowed the uprising to flower without exposing loyalists to retribution."
"The palace at Phallus was nearly empty this time of year,"
Atapal added. "A few hundred Wilderlords patrolling the streets, and 1,000 loyalist troops guarding the gates, and the city was ready to welcome its duke back. Once we put the rebels in charge here in the dungeons," he added.
"But the city is yours, my duke, and soon the entire duchy."
Anguin just stared at the crowd below the gallery in disbelief.
You conquered my duchy for me," he said, shaking his head.
"Restored it, Your Grace,"
Lord Hans corrected. "Prime Minister Angriel, would you like to introduce His Grace to his subjects?" he suggested.
"I believe that is the traditional responsibility of your post, is it not?"
Why, yes. Yes, it is,"
Angriel said, tears in his eyes.
"It is, indeed."
"Allow me to assist, my lord," Tyndall grinned, casting a voice augmentation spell on the man. Angriel stepped to the podium, introduced himself. Many in the chamber were familiar with him and his reputation, and then introduced Anguin. The orphan duke gave a rousing, impromptu speech that whipped the crowd into a frenzy. He promised to restore the just rule of the House of Terrine, to punish the rebels, and to re-establish prosperity for all in the duchy. And when he announced the recovery of 2 Gilmoran baronies to his collection, the nobility went wild. Then he introduced Radin as his intended bride. That quieted the crowd. The House of Bimin was little liked, even among the loyalists, and Radin was widely suspected of complicity in the assassinations of the Duke and Duchess. Yet Anguin's eloquent introduction and tender description of Radin was worthy of a jongleur. By the time he was done, even Radin was crying. My head was swimming, and I don't remember much else specific from the occasion, save that the only person who looked less than ecstatic over the unexpected restoration was Rondal. My former apprentice looked troubled and thoughtful, continuously stealing glances at the slender young white-haired thief who had apparently arranged the entire thing. While Radin was being greeted by the Al-Shari, I chanced to overhear their conversation when Rundle took Gatina aside.
"You did all this?"
he asked. "You arranged an uprising, a coup, a restoration."
"I did, my lord,"
she bowed.
"I do hope you think it worthy.
You did all of this to impress me?"
"I did it for many reasons,"
Gatina assured him. "Patriotism, the honor of my house, the pure challenge of the problem," she admitted. "But foremost in my mind was the fact that you would not marry until both the Brotherhood of the Rat was defeated and the duchy restored to Anguin's rightful rule. I believe both of those conditions are met now."
Rundle was quiet for a moment. "So they are," he agreed reluctantly.
"Therefore, there should be no further impediment to us getting married," she continued in a reasonable tone.
"No, I suppose there isn't," my former apprentice agreed. Then he grinned, and I could hear it in his voice.
"You really are a remarkable girl, aren't you, my lord?"
she said so sweetly I could taste it.
"I wager I will make you an even more remarkable wife."
Chapter 77 Exile. The news of Anguin's sudden restoration spread throughout the Mirror Array, and quickly supplanted the fall of Pharis in importance. Not even the dragon attack on Castabriel was as astounding to the mind of the common man as the news that the Orphan Duke had, somehow, defeated the Five Counts and reclaimed his throne. In one day. Of course, that was not at all accurate. Only two of the Counts were actually captured, Reims and Erona. The Count of Caramas quickly capitulated to Anguin's rule and swore fealty, for what it was worth. The Count of Arangalan was sailing with the fleet, and the Count of Cothramal, in the north, had been slain in his bed by loyalists fed up with his cruel dictates. But those details of history paled in comparison to the Orphan Duke's sudden restoration. Such a feat of political and military success had never been recorded in the annals of the five duchies. It was a fascinating tale, much of which I only learned later. Indeed, it was a feat worthy of the greatest of wizards, accomplished by the determination of one 14-year-old girl and her family. Not only had Gatina managed to stall and subvert nearly every predictable response amongst the rebel lords who might interfere, she had ensured that the loyalist forces in Alshar were in positions to control the strategic resources of the duchy. From the northern castle of Getamore, now controlled by Count Salgo, the loyalist forces quickly gathered along the banks of the mighty Mandros. Gatina's preparations had not been perfect. Several times rebel forces managed to assemble to contest with the loyalists. Nearly 500 managed to gather in Inmar, when it was clear that the rebellion was facing insurrection. But 200 Wildelords, leading 800 loyalists, met the rebels in a village outside of Inmar, and left the rebels' corpses feeding the crows. Surprisingly, military encounters were the exception, rather than the rule. Thanks to House Fertius's exhaustive exploration of the rebels' strengths, the loyalists knew precisely where and when, and, most importantly, whom to strike at the appointed hour. Most of Gatina's efforts involved parchment, not steel. Dozens of writs and warrants were issued the day before the loyalists struck, ensuring that the proper men to lead their troops were imprisoned, assassinated, or otherwise out of place to act at critical moments. A regime can only exist on the shoulders of a military force, and from Inmar, south, the young Wildelords Gatina used to infiltrate the enemy were the agents and symbols of Anguin's regime. It was a difficult proposition for folks who had been forced to support the Five Counts for so long. They were fearful of reprisals and reports of disloyalty, as the regime had taken of late to confiscation, rather than mere fines to punish disloyalty. Those who were even suspected of sedition by the rebels had lost their patrimonies and joined the ranks of the unemployed and trade-fallen. Yet, as the bold Wildelords floated downriver, they quickly took any citadel foolish enough to stand against them by storm. Beyond Inmar, the loyal men of the north took the great castle at Kul'tanyan by surprise, and using it as a base, quickly moved both downriver and overland to seize control of the administrative capital at Ruan at dawn. The rebel-appointed regent at Ruan, one of House Terrine's signature holdings, was interrogated and executed before noon. Sir Savarin of Colglian, a scion of an ancient Wilderlands house,
took control of the strategically important city and sent its loyalist forces south with the bulk of his men. As the flotilla of barges and boats carrying the victorious Wilderlords floated down from the north, they gathered additional forces at every port. Houses loyal to Anguin, carefully cultivated by House Furtius, quietly added their strength to the Wilderlords bearing the Anchor and Antlers banner down the river. By the time they approached Ruin, they were 5,000. By the time they approached Phallus, there were 15,000 knights, led by the popular and loyal Count Kalinin of Fioia. What few rebel forces who were able to deploy against the insurrection were quickly crushed by the time the impromptu army reached unsuspecting Phallus. Well prepared by House Furtius, the loyalists took the deserted capital in hours. What the daughter had stirred up, the father quickly took in hand. With the help of the loyalist army, and a ducal warrant naming him a Marshal of Alshar, handy things those. Lord Hans quickly organized, or had planned, and waiting for such an occasion, enough barons to ensure that the rebels had little chance of regaining the capital without a tremendous struggle. A council of high nobles met at the palace and acclaimed the return of Anguin, despite the dictates of the rebel council. There were some tense moments as the loyalists moved to take control of both government and capital from the unsuspecting rebels. Relying on an astonishing number of ducal warrants, dozens of rebels were rounded up by the squadrons of knights and hastily arrested. Most were languishing still in the dungeons of Phallus, awaiting Anguin's justice. Once Anguin was officially restored to the capital, at Gatina's bridal shower, the ducal court from Verone quickly took control of the palace and its offices, supplanting the rebels' appointees at the point of a sword, if necessary. A spirit of fierce Alshari patriotism, associated with the House of Terene, spread across the coastlands, until even stalwart vassals of the Five Counts were lining up to ensure their vows of fealty to the Duke were heard and duly recorded. Alia and I stayed long enough to see Anguin announce his engagement and enjoy the banquet arranged for the occasion, but then we left, quickly. No doubt I could have been of some use, but Pentandra had things well in hand. In all honesty, I was troubled at the thought of being in such a volatile situation as a revolution with a woman who still looked suspiciously at spoons. We returned to Sevendor that evening after the gala in Phallus, but I eagerly kept pace with the news from my friends and allies in Alshar. It was fascinating from a political perspective. Much of Anguin's work had been done for him. While Gatina had been plotting the uprising, her parents had wisely been preparing for the aftermath, understanding that revolutions were about more than mere riots and slogans. There was a lot of anxious moments as the Wilderlands court assumed power in the metropolitan Phallus. Though Anguin had a functioning court in Verone, it was ill-suited for the complexities of managing a population 50 times greater than the Wilderlands. Hans and his family had therefore thoughtfully selected candidates for deputy positions, who would serve for a year, until Anguin could find more permanent replacements. The problem of the fleet was solved, ultimately, by duplicity. Though the Sea Lords were oft the first to rebel against land-born rulers, they also needed their havens to resupply their corsairs. Most of the Sea Lords had substantial holdings along the Bay of an Ultramar, holdings that Anguin seized while they were away. That included the Sea Tower that guarded the only safe approach through the hazardous shoals of Sinbar. Much credit goes to the loyal house of Cananatus of Sangsara. The Sea Lords there had quickly seized the Sea Tower, with Lord Hans's guidance, and quickly found themselves in possession of a strategic fortress no less important than Gettermore. The enterprising Viscount of Sangsara, seeking credit and favour from the ascendant, Ducal House, enacted a plan to subdue the rebel fleet. As the ships approached the mighty Sea Tower, the same man who had passed them through in the spring allowed them to return. Of course, they didn't realize he had turned his cloak and come out in support of Anguin, once he realized which way the tides were flowing. As he admitted each Alshari ship through the straits and directed it to a port to unload and dispose of their loot and human cargo, he ensured that the port in question was ready to receive them. Once the ships were docked, they were swarmed with loyalists who took control of them and freed their captives. The captains and officers were imprisoned. At some point, word got out to the fleet that Anguin was in charge, not the Count of Arangalan. That caused a number of independent pirates and Farisi ships to flee the straits before they could be captured and held for justice. Luckily for them, the censors holding Faris were quite open to a return of the Farisi fleet. The native Al-Shari sea lords, who feared Anguin's justice the most, left with them. With word of the general amnesty the orphan duke was extending to the fleet, many relented and returned. It took weeks for the final pockets of resistance to fall, either through negotiation or force of arms. Count Salgo in particular led the loyalist forces in the few battles that resulted, his victories earning him a generous reward and the confiscated county of Reims from his grateful sovereign. Anguin spent months contending with the mess the interregnum left for him. There had not been ducal authority to rely upon for more than 5 years, since his father had taken his family on an unassuming trip to the summer capital. Now that ducal authority was returned, it was requiring almost all of Anguin's time and attention to administer it. If the restoration was a welcomed surprise to the court of Al-Shar, it was a shock to the court of Castal and the royal court. For one thing, it put Tavard in an even more negative light when Anguin sent a relief force to his men in Maiden's Pool, not to rescue them, but to bring them food and additional supplies. I learned later that rather than reconquer the marginal domain himself, as the lord of the town was a rebel, Anguin confiscated the holding and gifted Maiden's Pool to Tavard at Yule. As it turned out, that was the only holding House Bimin had in Al-Shar now. The terms of Radin's dowry gave nearly every parcel of land in southern Al-Shar claimed by House Bimin back to House Tereen. That included some prime estates and incredibly productive lands, lands that Grendine had coveted since she was a girl. To lose all of that in return for Maiden's Pool was a subtle insult. Tavard, by all accounts, was not amused by the gift. He appointed his lackluster former Master of Waves, the Tenant Lord, as punishment. Indeed, Tavard was reportedly furious at the entire affair. He protested directly to his father about Anguin's actions, without being able to articulate exactly how his cousin managed to violate the law by reassuming control of lands that were his by right. Rad might have been sympathetic to his son's case, but the Law Brothers were not. Anguin had every right to reclaim his patrimony, they informed him, without his king's permission. By late autumn, Anguin had relocated the majority of his court to Phalas, secure in his holding of the south. He appointed Count Markadine interim regent for the northern capital and placed him in command of the 3rd Al-Shari Commando. But the governance of the Wilderlands was in transition anyway, so it was an opportune time for the court to go south. After the Wilderlands, the cosmopolitan nature of the southern capital must have been overwhelming. Duke Anguin established a full governing court at the palace within weeks, and by Yule, reunited Al-Shar was functioning under the banner of the Anchor and Antlers once again. I was gratified to see Anguin and Radin take their administration seriously. Beginning with the execution of the Counts of Reims and Irona, the administration of justice to the rebels was swift and terrible. But that was not the limit of his governance. Indeed, Anguin saw the opportunity of the restoration to correct many long-standing injustices in his father's policies